Hey listeners, my fabulous colleagues Amy Bernstein and Amy Gallo are back with a new season of Women at Work. You know, it's your guide to whatever you're facing at work, from anxiety to Gen AI. Listen to new episodes of Women at Work every Monday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the HBR IdeaCast from Harvard Business Review. I'm Adi Ignatius, Editor-in-Chief, and on the phone today I have Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense for both Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and author of the new book, Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary of War. Secretary Gates, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So you're somebody who has spent really years and years working in Washington at several institutions and for at least a couple of presidents. And I guess before we talk about specifics, I'd love to get your general take on the culture of Washington, what works, what doesn't work.
I think that, first of all, we need to be honest and admit that Washington politics have always been ugly since the beginning of the Republic. At least we haven't had a former vice president and secretary of the Treasury shooting each other recently, as happened early on with Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. But I think what's differentiated the period of the last, particularly I'd say the last 20 years, is that the polarization and the ugliness of the politics has actually begun to impede the ability to get the government's business done. And, I mean, we've had ugly politics during Watergate, during Vietnam, and so on, just in sort of modern times, and the impeachment of President Clinton and so on. But what I think really has changed in Washington, and I saw it, I actually worked for eight presidents, beginning with Lyndon Johnson, and it is the fact that the bridge builders in the middle, in both the House and the Senate, have largely chosen to leave out of frustration, and most of them were not defeated, but they chose to leave because they couldn't get anything done. And I think it's this inability to get the government's business done that has changed most dramatically. And I'll just give you one specific example. I submitted five budgets for the Department of Defense under Presidents Bush and Obama. And not once in the nearly 5 years I was secretary did I have an appropriation at the beginning of the fiscal year. They just couldn't get it done.
And you describe the problem, but why has it happened? I mean, as you say, we have a history of this in this country of dysfunctionality, I guess. You know, all of us are imagining that things are worse than they've been, at least in recent times. But, you know, how did it become so hyperpartisan and dysfunctional lately?
I think it's been a result of several trends that are partly structural and partly political. I think the increasing partisanship of the redistricting process has played a big part in it. Out of 435 seats in the House of Representatives, there are probably only 50 or so that are actually competitive now, because over the last several decades, the districts have increasingly been drawn in a way to provide safe districts for either Republicans or Democrats. And so the really important elections are the primaries, usually held in the spring, or the party caucuses, depending on how the candidates are chosen. And so the candidates have to appeal to their party's most ideological, hardcore base. And so you've had more and more people being elected to Congress who come from a safe district, don't have to worry about re-election, but are required to take increasingly hardline or ideological positions. And so I would say that the people who are hardcore ideologues on both the left and the right have come to have significantly greater influence in both parties in Washington. And I think that has reduced the maneuvering room of the moderates, and it's been the moderates who have generally been on both the left and the right who have chosen to leave or who have found themselves essentially unable to bring the two sides together.
Okay, so in that environment, there you are running an institution, running the Pentagon, running the CIA at one point. How do you function profitably in an environment like that?
Well, first of all, I had an advantage in that I was operating in the realm of national security, and so a lot of the domestic issues, from social issues to economic issues that are the most polarizing, if you will, between the two parties, were not under my, I had no responsibility for that. So by focusing on national security, and I think by being identified as nonpartisan, I was able to work with both sides. And I think one of the themes in the book is, as difficult as it was, I was actually able to make the system work in terms of getting some big things done in the Department of Defense and in national security. My worry is that the absence of other senior people who have credentials on both sides of the aisle will make that an increasingly unique experience.
Now, your book talks about something that political analysts also talk about a lot, which is that, yes, Washington may be hyperpartisan, may be dysfunctional, but that's part of the beauty of the American system, that it's actually difficult to do anything drastic. Having served so many years in Washington, what do you think about that statement?
Well, I think that it does make it harder to do something drastic, although I think, you know, there'd be a lot of people who would say that the Affordable Care Act was a pretty dramatic action, and particularly the way it was voted by only, in essence, by only one party. And I think that it has become more difficult to address any of the serious problems that we face as a country, whether it's infrastructure or education or immigration or a host of other issues. And again, I would go back to what I was saying earlier, in that I think what's changed is that increasingly compromise has come to be regarded as a dirty word. It becomes synonymous with selling out or abandoning one's principles, and yet the way the system is structured, the way the founders created it, it can only work through compromise. And so when you have people going to Washington determined not to compromise, that is almost a guarantee that you'll have paralysis.
Now, you've spent a lot of time in the private sector as well. Are there lessons from the private sector that could be applied, that should be applied, that, you know, how do you change a situation in Washington? I mean, there are best practices from the real world. Any way to move them into Washington?
No, I think that the real problem is peculiar to government and governance. And as I say, redistricting is a major issue that has evolved over the last several decades, has become much worse in terms of making it more partisan. I think that the weakening of the committee chairs and the leadership in the Congress has made it worse. I think that the 24/7 media environment has made it worse. These are all things that are peculiar to government. But I would say, as I say in the book, but our leaders are not helpless, even in the light of these developments. The reality is, if they would begin to treat one another more civilly, if they would stop purposely distorting the facts, if they would stop demonizing one another, if they would just listen to each other and acknowledge that the other side may have a point. As I said, I've worked for 8 presidents, and I'll tell you, none of them had a monopoly on revealed truth. And same thing is true on Capitol Hill. So if these guys would be willing to listen to each other and treat each other as colleagues, even if they disagree, then I think you actually could make some progress on some of these issues, even if you're not able to fix some of these structural problems. Although I will say, on the redistricting, there are some efforts underway to try and address that problem. One is, as California has done, to take redistricting out of the hands of the state legislature and put it in the hands of an independent body. Another is open primaries, where the top 2 vote-getters are the 2 who face off against each other in the fall, so they clearly have to have a broader constituency that they appeal to. So there are some solutions that the states are experimenting with that can fix or mitigate some of these longer-term problems. But in the meantime, just the way people treat each other in Washington could make a difference.
Now, in the book, you're critical of President Obama's effort to assemble a so-called team of rivals. What, in your mind, went wrong there?
Well, I don't think he did something that turned out badly in that respect. I think that other than differences between the White House and the Departments of State and Defense on the Afghan surge in 2009, this team, if you will, Biden, who ran against him, Hillary Clinton, who ran against him, I, who had worked for President Bush, the truth is, on almost all other issues, we worked together pretty well. So I think that other than on one or two issues, that this was a team that actually did get along pretty well and certainly got along well personally. I think that there were some issues, like Afghanistan, where there were some bitter differences, frankly. There was a lot of suspicion in the White House of the military. But I think these things were not a manifestation of putting together a team of rivals, but rather the substantive differences and issues themselves.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about the leadership styles of a few people, and maybe let's start with President Obama. How would you characterize his leadership approach and its effectiveness?
I think that one of the things that surprised me that I write about is that for a guy who had never run anything, really, to speak of, I found him very decisive. He liked to analyze things very thoroughly when he had the time to do so, and he would take whatever time was necessary. He would tell me time and again, if I don't understand it, I can't explain it. And so he would take a lot of time on these issues, but at the same time, when he could. But at the same time, when he had to make an immediate decision, and often in matters of life and death, he did not hesitate from making those decisions and never looked back. So I found for somebody who had not been an executive, if you will, he took to being an executive and making tough decisions quite quickly.
Let me ask you about then President George W. Bush. Same question.
Well, I think that he was not as analytical as President Obama. He was much more comfortable going on his gut instinct or on his own instincts. But by the same token, he would listen to people. He, like Obama, welcomed disagreement among his senior policy advisors. He wanted to hear the different points of view. But at the end, I think he was more willing to make decisions based on his own instincts rather than sort of a 360-degree analysis of a problem. But they both were decisive, and both, I thought, very tough-minded. Now, I'm talking about the time when I spent with them. So I was in the last 2 years of the Bush administration, so I had a very experienced president. And I was in the first 2.5 years of Obama's administration, and so can't speak to anything that's happened over the last 2.5 years. But that's how I found them.
Now, you've described Obama as, you know, kind of a micromanager, kind of a control freak type. I guess, what advice would you give future presidents on how to exercise their leadership skills and, you know, to what extent they need to manage and micromanage and to what extent they need to sit back?
Well, I think that, quite honestly, the way that I did it at the Defense Department is the way I would recommend it to the president. You need to be in charge. Everybody knows you need to be in charge. Everybody needs to know you will make the decisions and you're not afraid to make decisions. You need to be knowledgeable enough to make intelligent decisions. And you have to drive the agenda. You have to decide what are the issues that I'm going to expend my time and political capital on and so on. But then you have to have enough confidence in your subordinates, whether it's cabinet officers or in the Department of Defense, to assign them responsibility for execution of the decisions that you make. And then hold them accountable. If they don't do a good job of it, replace them. But once you begin to centralize day-to-day operational roles inside the White House, I think you're bound for trouble. And once you try to micromanage the Department of Defense with 3 million employees, you're in trouble. You need what I call in the book micro-knowledge, if you will, but not micromanagement.
Well, so let's talk more about this, because now I think we're talking about the leadership style of Robert Gates. And I, you know, I'd like to hear more about what you've learned about managing organizations, and particularly, as you say, you know, there's probably no organization more complex than the U.S. Defense Department.
I think one of the, perhaps the biggest challenge in leading a big public institution in particular is how you make change and how you bring about enduring change in a huge institution. And my view has been for a long time that, you know, the truth is in public institutions, almost everybody has tenure of one kind or another. And if they don't like what you're doing, they can just outlast you. They were there before you got there. They'll be there after you leave, and all they have to do is wait you out. And so you have to make the professionals in the organization your allies in making change. And you have to show why it's important to make that change, get them on board in terms of what your vision for change is, and then make them your partners in implementing the change so that they assimilate it and it becomes their program as well as yours. And so they'll defend it after you leave. So I had a very close relationship, I think, with both the uniform and civilian leaders in the Department of Defense. I never made a single decision without consulting the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And whenever I had big budgetary or programmatic decisions to make, I involved the service secretaries, the chiefs of staff of the services, the combatant commanders, all of the principal leaders of the department were involved. When I did the big programmatic changes in 2009 and cut nearly three dozen big defense programs, something that had never been done before, in that period of time, much less by one secretary, I think I had over a two-month period something like 40 or 45 meetings with the senior leadership of the department. So particularly in public institutions, it's important to make the professionals your partners in the process, and I tried to do that. But going back to something I said earlier, you also have to hold them accountable. And so when I fired the Secretary of the Army over the Walter Reed scandal with respect to the handling of outpatient wounded warriors, or when I fired the Chief of Staff and Secretary of the Air Force over the mishandling of nuclear materials, that also sent a powerful message within the Department of Defense that I might treat everybody with respect and I might not yell or pound the table or anything, but if you didn't do your job properly, you would be fired.
I see that you fairly recently joined the board of Starbucks. I know you've been on several corporate boards. I'm imagining that the private sector must seem like a breeze compared to working in Washington.
Well, let's just say that I think that you know, one of the things that's different is that corporate executives tend not to personalize things the way politicians do in Washington. And where I think one of the biggest differences is in Washington, the oversight role is performed by the Congress, and their interests are not necessarily the same as those they are overseeing. That's very different in a regular corporate board, where the board's interest and the interest of the leadership of the company really need to be aligned and work together to accomplish the objectives. And the board provides the oversight for that process. But you have a very bad situation if you have a board that has an adversarial relationship with the CEO. And yet that's pretty commonplace in D.C.
So Secretary Gates, this has been a really interesting conversation, and I want to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
That was Robert Gates, author of the new book, Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary of War. For more, go to hbr.org.